Before I begin this episode, I want to give a trigger warning to our audience members that this conversation contains materials of accusations of child abuse and death of children. Hello, welcome to a Northern California Innocence Project podcast presenting the voices of NCIP, whether that means the voices of staff, clients, students, or our supporters. Here at NCIP, we have three main branches of our work. The first is our work to exonerate or seek freedom for those who have been wrongfully convicted. Second is our work to educate law students here at Santa Clara Law School or to our general public through speaking engagements. Lastly, NCIP is in a coalition with California Innocence Project and Loyola Project for the Innocent, called the California Innocence Coalition, where we work together to reform laws and create legislation that supports and benefits those who have been affected by or who are at risk of wrongful convictions. So I want to thank listeners for your interest in learning more about NCIP and the work that we do. Today, we will discuss one of NCIP's major projects examining the unreliable science of shaken baby syndrome and its role in wrongful convictions. Before I let my colleagues introduce themselves, my name is Michelle Canny. I am NCIP's Communication Associate, and I will be hosting today's conversation. So now, let me pass it to our speakers today.
Thanks, Michelle. My name's Paige Canab. I am an attorney here at NCIP. I've been working here since I graduated in 2007, so it's been, I guess, almost 15 years. For the past 10 of them, I've gotten really into shaken baby syndrome, and the more I realized that there was no science, no real evidence supporting it, the more I got interested in what we could do to help everyone who's been wrongfully convicted based on shaken baby syndrome determinations.
Hi, I'm Lauren Barbosa Finley, and I have been at NCIP now for almost 2 years as a employee. I am an Equal Justice Works Fellow sponsored by Fenwick and West. But prior to that, I was a clinical student at NCIP for 2 years when I was a law student, and I was actually a student of Paige. I had the amazing pleasure of working with and learning from her, and now I get to continue to work under her and have her as my mentor, which is an incredibly amazing experience. And I get to work on shaken baby syndrome and what they now sometimes call it abusive head trauma cases. When I was a student, Paige introduced me to these cases and really just shared what she likes to call her obsession with the injustice in these cases, because there truly is a really egregious double tragedy in that many of the people in these cases lost their child or somebody that they deeply cared about, and then they're also blamed for that loss and being responsible for that loss, and oftentimes sent to prison for murder, which is absolutely heart-wrenching to think about. So I'm really proud to have this project and to talk to you more about it, and yeah.
Well, thank you, both of you, for joining me today and for sharing to our audience the importance of this type of work that we do. So can either of you give me a description of your project, you know, including a name, how it's organized, and maybe a timeline?
So I think in the office, we kind of just call it the Shaken Baby Syndrome Abusive Head Trauma Project, but really it's just our Equal Justice Works project. And really the main goal of it is to identify and exonerate individuals who have been wrongfully convicted based upon what we now know is unreliable forensic medical science about shaken baby syndrome, and what the findings of what those three findings actually mean and what you can diagnose based on those three findings.
And just to jump in there, one of the things that made us want to, and really Lauren really did this, start a project where we could more systematically identify and approach these cases is there have been errors that they realize and acknowledge in shaken baby syndrome dogma. So like they used to say, it would take a multi-story fall to generate the kind of injuries you see in these cases, and that they can't happen with short accidental falls. And so all these parents who said, and caretakers who said, my child fell off a changing table, off a couch, from my arms. They were all told, like, no, it's impossible. You must have abused your child. And we now know that's wrong. And some of the medical literature even talks about, like, there's one study that lists 140 cases that were determined to be abuse cases, in part because the caretaker had said it was a short distance fall. But we don't know who those 140 cases are. So this is just an area where the numbers seem really big. And you know, it's really possible that so many of these people, if not all of them, are innocent. And so Lauren came up with this great idea on how to, you know, start finding them and seeing if we can fix some of the injustice in a more, either in a more systematic way or a way that makes greater change and so it can happen more quickly for more people.
I think the main idea of our project really was just that we wanted to go and identify cases where we believe there could be wrongful convictions based upon a misdiagnosis of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma, and then also litigate those cases, which means, you know, go to post-conviction, go into post-conviction litigation where we attempt to get those convictions overturned. And then through the casework and through identifying cases where we do think there was wrongful convictions, we set out to kind of synthesize data and be able to identify the key issues with how SBS-AHT diagnoses are being used in the criminal legal system and inform really our policy efforts. And then also be able to, on a platform like this, share those facts to really help engage people and help people understand the full picture of how and why this is unreliable and why it is so unfair and unjust. And when we did come up with the project and finally have a proposal that we felt really proud of, we presented that to Equal Justice Works, and they found us a sponsor in Fenwick and West, and we're really grateful for their support and continued support.
Great, thank you. And I know we touched on this a little bit, but I just wanted to kind of go into why this project is so important. Why was this something that NCIP wanted to focus on?
You know, there's one of the things that DNA has highlighted is that forensics go wrong a lot in criminal convictions. And a lot of the wrongful conviction cases that we know about had some kind of faulty forensics. And in some of those, like in the microscopic hair comparison cases, the FBI actually came out and said, we made a mistake. And they identified for themselves and sent out letters to all the cases where they had someone testify or someone they trained testified falsely in these cases. And so, you know, the dream is for something like that to happen. And since that's not happening yet on the government or on the medical side, we just felt like that's a really big hole that we could fill.
And there's a quote that has been circulated from, I think it was around 2012, from Dr. Norman Guthcouch, who was actually the person who proposed the hypothesis of shaken baby syndrome all the way back in the 70s. And he actually recognized that the hypothesis that he always said was just a hypothesis, that these findings could be from shaking a baby. He recognized that that hypothesis had been mutated into this really dispositive legal theory and had likely sent a lot of innocent people to prison. And he called for somebody to kind of review those cases and actually do a check on if there are many people who are innocent and wrongfully convicted based on that hypothesis. And I think we kind of wanted to in some way answer that call.
So you don't know if there are any organizations that have done something similar like this before?
Not in shaken baby syndrome. We haven't heard of anybody doing this. And we've actually reached out to other projects and other organizations to ask if they've done something like this, and no one has. But we have been sharing it out, and I think other people are now starting to, which we're really excited about.
That's so awesome.
It's really exciting.
We're one of the first. Well, thank you both for sharing this information. I just wanted to kind of give our listeners a little bit more background on shaken baby syndrome. So can either of you explain that further?
Yeah, I'm going to build on what Lauren just said. So Dr. Norman Guthcouch was a pediatric neurosurgeon in the 70s, and he was treating some children who had some bleeding inside their head and nothing on the outside, no bumps, no bruises, no broken skulls. And at the time he thought, and that's, you know, not crazy, that bleeding had to be from some kind of trauma. And so he's looking for a traumatic explanation, and he came up with shaking. And the analogy I've heard is of an egg, right? If you want to scramble the inside and not damage the outside, you could shake it. And it just, it's one of those things, as Lauren said, he proposed it as a hypothesis, but it just became hugely popular. And another pediatric radiologist from the U.S. picked up on it, and he added retinal hemorrhages, a little bit of bleeding behind the eyes. So we're talking now about a little bit of bleeding over the brain, a little bit of bleeding behind the eyes, and often brain swelling. And it went from this idea that shaking could cause these things to training doctors that any time they saw these three things, it had to be violent shaking. And no one knows exactly how that happened, how we went from hypothesis to diagnosis, but what we know is that for decades, it was in the medical textbooks, it was taught in medical schools, and so all these doctors were trained and believed and then went into court and testified that the only possible explanation, because a child hadn't been through a motor vehicle accident or a multi-story fall, the only explanation was shaking. And so all these families were separated and people were sent to prison entirely based on doctor testimony. And I think that's really important to understand that in so many of these cases, the doctors are the only evidence of abuse. Where the cases Lauren and I have been focusing on, they're all, people were described as good, loving, kind, gentle parents. Their friends and family, everyone who knew them, says they would never have intentionally harmed a baby. And so it really did come down to doctor testimony that they believed the medical, that usually just findings inside the head, had to be abuse. And it turns out most of that was just wrong. These same findings come from minor accidents, they come from medical conditions, they come from infections. You just see them in a wide variety of places. And so now what was presented as this very certain evidence of guilt, it turns out, was just almost made up, like a guess at something that's never been proven, but just made sense to people. And the more we look, the more we realize all of the assumptions were wrong. Like, he was looking for a traumatic explanation, and it turns out you don't need a traumatic explanation because the bleeding and swelling can happen without any trauma at all.
Thank you for that explanation, Paige. I hope that gives everyone a better picture of why we have decided to go into this type of work. So can one of you tell me then what have been some key findings from this project?
Well, there have been a lot of them. We have a spreadsheet with an insane number of categories that we are collecting data for. But to give some of the highlights, I mean, the number alone, through our searches, we came up with 591 cases just in California. 71% of the people were men, interestingly, of the people accused. Of those, the vast majority was the birth father. So one of the, I think, you know, two of the things that come to mind for people think of mothers with postpartum, which doesn't seem to be what's happening in these cases. And there's also a lot of talk of, you know, mom's boyfriends, but that actually isn't what the numbers bear out. There are also some really interesting race statistics. I think they're not necessarily surprising because they echo a lot of what we see in the criminal legal system at large. But where race was identified, 75% of the people were BIPOC. If you look at all the cases, in the conviction cases, it goes up to 77%, and in the life sentences, it goes up to 80%. And then if you break it down, Black people are by far the most overrepresented. They make up 20% of the convictions, and they're only 5% of the California population. Latinx people are also overrepresented, and white people are hugely underrepresented. And, you know, Lauren was actually talking to an expert earlier today who, Dr. Judy Melanick, who also worked on a paper that looked at cognitive bias and forensics. And they gave a scenario of a child death that they sent out to a whole bunch of experts. And they changed whether the caretaker was a Black boyfriend or a white grandmother. And in the black boyfriend scenario, the opinion came back a homicide way more often than in the white grandmother, where they said it was an accident. So again, I think not necessarily surprising to a lot of our listeners and to those of you who are, you know, steeped in the criminal legal system and the racism that exists in it largely by design. But it's certainly something you see in these cases. And one of the things Lauren and I have talked about over and over again is there's not just implicit bias in these cases, sort of the ones we don't recognize, but there's also conscious bias because the medical literature says that race and socioeconomic factors are risk factors for abuse. That's what they call them. So they're being told to consciously consider someone's race and socioeconomic status in determining whether something is going to be called an accident or whether it's going to be undetermined or whether it's going to be a homicide.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like I had to take a moment to hear that because that's directly coming from medical experts, which are being used in our legal system.
Yeah. And it's literally how they're trained. Like it's right. In their published papers in the peer-reviewed literature, it says, you know, race is a risk factor for abuse. Socioeconomic is a risk factor for abuse. And so yeah, that the numbers are so disparate, I think follows very, very clearly from that.
And is another reason why this project is so important and people should realize that this is going to be one of, you know, the next major contributors to wrongful convictions, for sure.
Right. And, you know, really determines who's affected. Our own listeners can probably, you know, gather what communities, what people are being targeted for these type of accusations against them. But thank you for that. Any other findings that you want to share?
One of the really interesting things about shaken baby syndrome is because all of the doctors were trained that way, a lot of them, there are doctors who are now on the innocence side who initially used to testify for the prosecution. They used to say all the same things that we see in these cases over and over again, that it would take the forces of a multi-story fall or a motor vehicle accident. That it can't be from shortfalls, that there's no infection to explain it, et cetera, et cetera. Because in medical school, you know, you're trained on how to diagnose things. When you look at, when you see these things, diagnose this. Or when you see this, you flag this. But what they're not usually doing is looking at what's the actual underlying evidence for it. And so of the ones who have sat down then and looked at the evidence, there are a number of doctors who have become really concerned and who now, I mean, some of them do almost entirely pro bono work. They don't charge on these cases. They're just out there trying to correct these wrongs. And they have endured all sorts of threats and scorn. I mean, if you think about any big idea that everyone's held on to, like the earth was flat, and then the first people come and say, no, it's round, everybody thinks they're crazy, right? And sometimes people, like, you know, there were philosophers who were poisoned for having different ideas, people executed for saying something that was against the contrary belief system. And so there are doctors who have continued to put themselves out there, even though they're going against the grain, and changing a commonly held belief is really hard to do.
Okay, thank you. I think that kind of leads me now into thinking about what are some of the challenges or misconceptions that you experienced in starting.
I think one of the biggest challenges in this project is the instant gut reaction that somebody has when they hear the words shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma in relation to a small child or an infant. Like, instantly the general population is going to have a visceral reaction because it's incredibly sad to think about a baby or a small child passing away. And
we all thought it was real. Like, yeah. We've all grown up thinking shaken baby syndrome is a real thing.
Yeah, we've all heard about it. We've seen the billboards and pamphlets and those types of things. And you do think that it's real. And I think that that's one of the biggest challenges is facing people who instantly are shut down by the thought of it because there is this really emotional pull to there being a baby or a child involved. But when you get to understanding this, the actual whole picture of it, and understanding this unreliable science being used in the way that it is as legally dispositive, has actually harmed a lot of families and the child protective services system and court systems have actually broken up countless families and sent countless parents to prison who will never be able to have the same relationship with other children or with their spouse who is still supportive of them. So I think that there a challenge is being able to have people understand that there is a great cost on the other side as well, because I think the number one thing that a person who is in the shoes of a child abuse pediatrician or a pediatrician who is trying to diagnose abuse is going to be that they would rather be on the side of caution, right? Because it's better to say something and report what you think might be abuse. It's better to do that than it is to not do that and then have something bad happen. But there also are major consequences to misdiagnoses and to making the wrong call in these cases. I mean, it's detrimental. It truly is life and death also for the person that's being accused.
Yeah, and I think the, like, tying into that, right, the doctors who have spent their lives believing in shaken baby syndrome and diagnosing abuse. And, you know, I definitely thought coming into this that if they were just aware of how bad the evidence base is, they would just change their minds. And one of the things I've realized is just it's not that easy to change your mind, right? And I think especially for if you've devoted your life, you became a pediatrician because you love kids, you think of yourself as always protecting children, and to have been wrong means that you sent kids to the foster care system and separated them from their families when they shouldn't have been. It's like it's almost too big, right? And I always try and, you know, give other people the benefit of the doubt. And so I think about it if, you know, someone came up to me and they were like, every person you've gotten out of prison is guilty, not innocent. And I would be like, you're crazy. You have no idea what you're talking about. And so I think that that's something that we're up against is how do you change minds, especially when the stakes are so high?
Mm-hmm. Well, then who benefits, you know, from this type of project and this type of knowledge that we're uncovering?
I think our hope is sort of twofold, that like first layers, the people in prison and the families who have been separated and who have been told something that wasn't true. But I do think our hope is eventually to reach the broader audience, especially the medical community. I think there are some people who aren't deep in this enough in this that they may be open to change. And also coming up with ways to do this in a way that gives people a way to be okay to change their mind or be okay to say we might have been wrong. And again, I'm not saying that's easy. But if we can really be empathetic enough and figure out a way to talk about this so it's not like we're two camps accusing the other of wrongdoing, then, you know, maybe we can make some progress.
Right.
And I also think, like, largely everybody in our society benefits from us being able to move forward and recognize, and like as Paige just said, not pointing at wrongdoers or anything of that nature, but just recognize that there is ingrained in this diagnosis unreliability and circular logic. And if we're able to make that more of a mainstream notion and have people understand that, it will allow for this to not continue happening, right? Because this could happen to anybody. I mean, Paige talks about her experiences with her child, and after doing all of this work, I certainly am going to be terrified as a mother of, like, you know, what could potentially, this small fall could happen, or, you know, any type of injury. Now that's going to be the main thing that I think about. So I think that it will benefit everybody because anybody could be in the position to be wrongfully accused.
And that's such a great point, Lauren, because right now we spend all this time warning parents about the dangers of shaking, and we don't tell them enough about the dangers of shortfalls. Mm-hmm. And what can happen from a shortfall, and that you should, even if everything seems okay, rush your kid to the hospital and seek medical help because they could just stop breathing at any moment. And so there's, I think, a huge public health benefit in getting this information out there.
Yeah, because there is that like instant cultural notion that kids fall all the time and they'll be okay, right? Like in one case, there's literally testimony from a doctor saying, oh no, if these findings could come from a shortfall, then all 317 beds in the ICU would be full of toddlers that fall, because toddlers fall every day. And yes, of course, that is true, and that toddlers fall every day, but that doesn't mean that in that one rare instance that a fall couldn't have caused these detrimental findings that end up in a fatality for a small child. I was talking to a pathologist actually last week, and she said, yeah, also the flu doesn't kill everybody, but you can say that some people don't die from the flu. And I think also with COVID and all the stuff that we've dealt with in the last 2 years, it's kind of a similar thing. Like, yes, not everybody's going to die from COVID, but some people for some reason are susceptible. And I think that analogy is definitely very useful in this sense, because in the rare instance, it can happen. And it's tragic, but it's also tragic that a parent or a caretaker could be blamed and sent to prison for it.
All right. So just kind of wrapping up a little bit, I know you both have mentioned some, you know, what you want to accomplish through this project, but I just want to go into that one last time. And to also maybe think about some goals you're hoping to reach and kind of what hopes you have for the future on a larger scale.
I am definitely hoping that we can get some, you know, either through the courts or through law enforcement agencies like the Attorney General's office or even the Department of Justice, just get some authority that acknowledges all of the changes that have happened, so that we're not having to explain to the courts over and over again and get each individual court to see, oh yes, this error has been made, or oh yes, shortfalls can cause these things. Because then we could just go in with each case and say, look, we already know this testimony was false, and here you can see why it was the thing that mattered the most in this case, that there was another evidence of abuse. So that's, for me, like one of the bigger picture goals of like having our system in some way acknowledge that things have changed, so that we can build off that instead of starting at, you know, step one at the very beginning in every case, which given the numbers is going to just take us forever if we have to do it that way. And, you know, like one of the things I've learned so deeply here is how much every person's life matters, and they're all worth spending years fighting for, but we won't be able to get to everyone if we do it that way. And then also for all the people who aren't represented by us, right? Like having all the people who fight for themselves, who have other lawyers, having that in place, so that, again, we're just not having to have this uphill battle every time, would be huge.
Yeah, and I think also like maybe a fantasy dream world unicorn scenario would be that, or maybe it's not, maybe in some time it will be possible, but that the medical community can further acknowledge and come to more of a consensus where, you know, the different disciplines can all put their knowledge together and recognize that this has been unreliable and really get to the bottom of understanding that there is circular logic. Because one thing that I think is important to note also is that the American Academy of Pediatrics for the first time acknowledged in 2020 that in fact shortfalls can cause fatal intracranial injuries. And it was just one little sentence, and I think that if the medical community were to acknowledge that they do now understand that, and on a larger scale promote and spread the idea that those things are possible, and like Paige was saying, warn parents, I think that it would begin to change the tides and turn the tides culturally, so that possibly in the future there's not just continuous mounting wrongful convictions from this idea.
That's really the other thing we should mention is, you know, sometimes when you initially learn about shaken baby syndrome, you get the sense that it's been like fully debunked. And so, of course, we're not doing this anymore. But that's actually not true. There are still prosecutions happening. There are tons of people still in prison. We know of people who are still on death row. And there are still prosecutions continuing. And I've come to think of this like the way Ibram Kendi explains racism and anti-racism. Like, if you just thought of it as one arc, it's really hard to understand, like, well, how is all this stuff still happening, right? But if you think of them as two separate paths with racism moving forward and anti-racism also making advances, it becomes a lot easier to process. And so I've come to think of shaken baby syndrome in a very similar way. There's been all this movement showing that it's wrong and unreliable and makes mistakes all the time. But there's also still papers being published promoting these diagnoses, and there are still doctors who are still testifying to it, and there are still people being prosecuted and families being separated. And so, but I think that's like one of our ultimate goals, is to be able to help also, like, so any random lawyer who gets one of these cases, or any great lawyer who gets one of these cases, having all of the materials that they need easily available to them so that they can do a great job and so that we can make sure this doesn't keep happening. And I think similarly, like, getting the information to the district attorney's offices and to law enforcement. One of the things our policy director, Melissa O'Connell, has been working with police officers who weren't aware that their confessions, the confessions that they're getting out of, you know, parents who are accused or caretakers who are accused, are then being used as the evidence base for the diagnosis, because all they know is they've been told by the doctors, well, it has to be this. And so they're getting a confession based on what the doctors are telling them. And then the doctors are using those confessions to say, well, we were right. And so, which is just another form of the circularity here that, you know, just getting the information out there does actually help, right?
Well, thank you both for speaking with us today. I also just wanted to kind of give our audience some takeaways after this conversation, because it is a lot to digest. But I think there is so much that we as an audience can do outside of this project to raise more awareness and to have some more advocacy towards creating this type of change in our legal system and our society. So one thing I mentioned earlier was that NCIP is part of the California Innocence Coalition, and we are currently working on a policy bill called SB 467 in California that is combating and challenging faulty forensic science used in the courts. So I don't know if one of you want to talk a little bit more about the bill and how that, you know, benefits this type of project as a whole, or other type of faulty forensic science used in the court systems. And then also, if one of you could also talk about just kind of ways that you would like the audience to get involved in this type of work that you are both doing today.
I think the first one is just, like, anytime you hear shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma, like, alarm bells should go off in your head, you know? And if we can get everyone there where, like, you hear that and immediately you start questioning whether it's real and looking into it for yourself, would be amazing. Senate Bill 467, we're super excited about, because it allows the courts to actually more carefully look at whether a forensic science technique or opinion has become controversial, and also what the basis for it is. So if it relies on circular reasoning, we know that's not reliable, right? We know circular reasoning is not an actual accepted scientific method, and that it causes all sorts of mistakes. And so it allows for a court, once someone's already been convicted, it allows for them to look at the science that's the basis for the conviction and say, you know, are there errors? Has it become controversial? Should we still be relying on this to keep someone in prison for the rest of their life?
Yeah. And I think also the alarm bells, and also spreading those alarm bells, right? Like, talk to people about this. There are a few really great podcasts about shaken baby syndrome and the cases. And I think that Do No Harm by Wondery is an amazing, amazing podcast. Mike Hixenbaugh does a really great job of exposing the racial disparities as well that happen. And There's also a really great documentary called The Syndrome, and that's available for free on Tubi, and that pays a lot of tribute to Dr. Plunkett, who is definitely a hero of mine, and I think Paige is, and somebody that we admire very much. May he rest in peace. And so, yeah, just talk about, share these podcasts, share this podcast, share articles that you see. There are a lot of great articles, like investigative journalism articles that are written on shaken baby syndrome and abusive head trauma, wrongful convictions. And I think just really spreading the awareness and showing people that changing that cultural narrative, really, I think is the best thing that we can try to have you do.
Yeah, I think showing people too that we believe them, you know, that we believe or that people are wrongfully convicted and wrongfully incarcerated right now due to shaken baby syndrome. All right, well, I just want to say thank you to both of you for spending your time with me today and educating our audience about this project. So if you want to learn more about NCIP, please go to ncip.org or follow us on social media at NorCalInnocence.